Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about a terrific podcast called Time to Eat the Dogs. It's hosted by Michael Robinson, a historian, and it's about exploration. Now, if you're clever, and I know you are because you listen to the New Books Network, you can probably figure out why a podcast about exploration would be called Time to Eat the Dogs. Well, Michael has interviewed many scholars and historians and researchers, and he even interviewed an astronaut about their books about exploration. You can find Time to Eat the Dogs at TimeToEatTheDogs.com. What else? You can also find it on iTunes. As I say, we really love this podcast at the New Books Network, and we love it so much that we're going to republish some of Michael's excellent interviews. And if I would just stop talking, which I'm going to do presently, you'll be able to hear one of those interviews. So I'm going to stop talking.
If you were a European captain during the Age of Sail, you could cross the Indian Ocean by staying far to the south, sailing in the cold, wild waters of the Southern Ocean. The winds here blew reliably to the east, and you could shorten your voyage by weeks if you survived. It's time to eat the dogs. I'm Michael Robinson. Today, Dr. Joy McCann discusses the great circumpolar ocean that surrounds Antarctica. McCann is the author of Wild Sea, A History of the Southern Ocean. She's a historian at the Center for Environmental History at Australian National University. Joy McCann, thank you so much for talking with me.
It's a pleasure, Michael.
So I was wondering if you could just describe, so that listeners can see it in their own minds, what does the Southern Ocean look like?
Yes, it's the Southern Ocean. I mean, some people know it as the Antarctic Ocean because, of course, it flows completely around Antarctica. But it is an enormous ocean. When you look at a map, you look at the whole southern part of the world, and it's all ocean. In fact, the southern hemisphere generally is often referred to as the ocean hemisphere. But the Southern Ocean is vast. It's around about a quarter of the world ocean, depending on where you draw the northern boundary, and that is an issue that's evolved over the last, developed over the last 20 years or so, where different nations have different boundaries. But overall, the way I have approached it in my book is to look at it historically as the ocean that extends southward from the tips of South America, South Africa, Australia and New Zealand, all the way to Antarctica. So that is a very large bit of ocean. It's stormy. It's one of the stormiest oceans on Earth. It's quite distinctive physically as well, because it is the only ocean that completely circumnavigates the world, and it has very little in the way of land to interrupt its flow. So certainly no land masses to define its flow, and it is incredibly windy. It has the winds of these latitudes between around 40 and 60 degrees south, known as the Roaring Forties, the Furious Fifties, and the Screaming Sixties, which is a very evocative way of describing the winds, and that's how the early sailors used to describe them. It also has the biggest current in the world, the Antarctic Circumpolar Current, which, as with the wind, it completely flows around the Earth, and it has the flow equivalent to 150 times the world's rivers. It is wow. phenomenal. It's a huge water mass, and it squeezes between the narrow gap, relatively narrow opening between the tip of South America and Antarctica in what's known as the Drake Passage, which is notorious for its storms and winds. The Antarctic Circumpolar Current squeezes between that 800-kilometre gap. And around those capes, the Cape of Cape Horn, as I mentioned, the Cape of Good Hope at the tip of South Africa, Cape Leeuwin, the tip of southwestern Australia, and there are a couple of other capes as well in Tasmania and New Zealand. Those five capes were known to early sailors from about the 18th century. Sailing around those capes was a notoriously difficult exercise because you have currents that are flowing around the continental landmasses and meeting the Southern Ocean. Mm. So it is a volatile ocean. It's renowned, has always been renowned for its storminess. Off Cape Horn, it's known as the Sailor's Graveyard because of the number of shipwrecks. And apart from that, of course, it also has distinctive undersea topography. So what we have through that ocean is a series of islands that literally surround Antarctica, sub-Antarctic islands and Antarctic islands, about 20 or so island groups, and they're tiny. They're like little black dots in the ocean of Bernadette Hintz, the Antarctic historian, calls them like jewels in the crown of Antarctica. And literally that's all there is in that ocean in terms of land.
So actually, since you were talking about these sailors and explorers that are going down into the ocean, it made me think as I was reading your book, which is beautifully written, by the way, how there's a paradox about the ocean in these stories of exploration, because in a way, the ocean is everywhere in these stories, but it's actually never the foreground of them. Mm. And it's interesting to me that you've foregrounded the ocean so much. And I was wondering why you decided to put the ocean in the middle rather than as the backdrop to any of a number of stories you could have written.
Hmm. That's a good question. I mean, when I came to thinking about the ocean and history, the obvious sources were all about the surfaces, the exploration, the discoveries of land, the development of trade, commerce and trade, whaling, sealing. But it all revolved around sailing from one landmass to another, or discoveries of new landmasses to colonise in. And colonisation is a big theme in the Southern Hemisphere. But I decided, as an environmental historian, I really wanted to also look at the natural environment as well. And I thought a lot about how I would do that. And I was inspired by Helen Roswedowski's work on Fathoming the Ocean, her book, which focused on the deep ocean and the discovery, if you like, of the deep ocean as an environment in its own right. Mm-hmm. So that really challenged me to think about the Southern Ocean as a three-dimensional environment, not just about above the surface, but also below. And as I developed my themes, I decided to put the ocean, the physical ocean, front and centre, at the centre of the narrative, and then to really explore it as a narrative of the ocean in which humans have imagined it, encountered it, experienced it, exploited it, and sailed across its surface and also explored its depths. So for me, it was a really quite a liberating way of understanding an environment, almost in a way more liberating than exploring in a land-based environment, because you have this incredible interconnectedness of everything in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And when I came across work by Elizabeth Borghese Mann, who was a maritime law expert who contributed to the development of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. She was heavily involved, I think, in the Club of Rome back in the 80s. And I read her work called The Oceanic Circle. And she was talking a lot about interconnectedness in ocean environments. And at that, I suppose, in a way, I was drawing from a lot of different kinds of literature, a lot of different sources, to really push these boundaries of thinking about the history of an ocean mm-hmm. in ways that I hadn't really come across in the past. So it really made sense for me to create or to use the physical elements of the ocean, the storms, the ice. Of course, it's a very icy place, prone to icebergs and sea ice, which covers much of the surface of the ocean during the winter months and melts to about a sixth of its size in the summer. So ice, fog, the fog which comes from the Antarctic convergence and the meeting of warmer and colder waters, which is an incredibly fertile area in terms of marine life and what drew the early whalers to this region. And of course, the storminess and the winds and the currents and the waves of the ocean itself. So they became the chapters in my book. And that really helped to remind me as I was writing the human history, was that I was constantly challenged to interweave the human and the natural in a way that was kind of an experiment in a way, but it really seemed to take on a life of its own as I was writing it.
Well, I've actually spoken to Helen Rozwadowski about the way people study oceans. And I remember a conversation with her where she was kind of shaking her head and saying, you know, people talk about the Atlantic world so much. You know, that's a very popular area of scholarship now. But the Atlantic itself isn't generally talked about very much. It's this kind of highway. And I think that your book very much is a story of that place. It really comes across. I want to reference something you just talked about when you said these whalers and merchants who are coming around the Cape of Good Hope and they're entering the Southern Ocean. And what's so interesting about the way you write about this is a strange place. It doesn't seem to operate the way other oceans do in terms of the temperature, in terms of, as you talked about, the convergence. So could you talk a little bit about what these sailors saw or experienced as they were entering this ocean, how it changed their navigation, things like that?
Yes, well, the first writing about this strange experience of sailing south into the high southern latitudes that I came across came from James Cook, who's well known to Australians because of his voyages on behalf of the British Admiralty to find and claim for England the unknown southern land as was imagined in Western philosophy. But Cook was involved in three voyages into the southern hemisphere, and the interest that I have in his story is his second voyage, in which he did actually reach the Antarctic Circle, in fact sailed across it three times. Not many people sort of know about that dimension to his voyages, because much of it is focused on claiming land and colonising Australia. But I think what is so important about his voyages is that he talks a lot about the physical nature of the Southern Ocean. In fact, he was, I think, one of the first to use the term Southern Ocean. And he noticed as he left the Cape of Good Hope and headed south, caught up with the winds of the Roaring Forties as he crossed latitude or around about 38 degrees south, he started noticing the intense cold. It was a sudden change in temperature in the water and in the air. And in fact, pretty much most of the stock that they'd brought on board the Resolution and the Adventure as they left the Cape of Good Hope, they died in the cold. It was just such an incredibly sharp drop in temperature. So that got me thinking about how other mariners, navigators, trading ships, migrant ships, how they describe the ocean and their first encounters. Most of those encounters that I was reading initially were around the Cape of Good Hope. And of course, there's the whole story about the development of shipping routes in the Southern Ocean during the 19th century after Cook and the earliest people to venture further south. He was followed very quickly by private sealing gangs, privately funded, who were often, we know very little about them apart from the archaeological evidence on some of the sub-Antarctic islands, but these sealers were spending months at a time in this region, but we don't have written records. Yeah. But then the whalers followed, and then we started getting more migrant ships sailing into these parts, obviously convict ships to Australia in the early days, and then the migrant ships. And during the 19th century, we had the many, many descriptions of the experience of sailing into this region. And all of them, are both a mixture of fear and awe.
Yeah.
Always people describe the magnificence of the swells, because when you can imagine sailing in the Roaring Forties from west to east, the swells follow the ship. They push the ships along. This is about 7,000 kilometres or so between the tip of South Africa and the Australian coastline. So the early navigators were trying to pick up those winds in the early sailing vessels to push them eastward. And in fact, there's a whole story about the development of the Great Sailing Circle and what Towson, one of the a British watchmaker, developed his own version of it, which became standard navigation guides for the early vessels.
Yeah, I had a historian, Jane Hooper, on a couple months ago to talk about Madagascar and the Madagascar trade.
Yeah.
And in her book, she talks about how merchant vessels started to figure out on the India trade that they could save time if they went east of Madagascar rather than go and hug the African coast. And what I found so interesting about your book is, in a sense, you extend that and say, yeah, well, that was just part of a new kind of thinking about navigation, which counterintuitively pushes the boats further south to pick up these screaming winds that are pulling ships or pushing ships east. And so my question is, how did people figure out? I mean, that's dangerous. Those are dangerous waters. Did you get any sense as you were looking at these stories of these sailors, like, is there a kind of point of no return for them? Are they trying, is there a sweet spot that they're trying to find? Because I would imagine that your chances of wrecking are go up a lot as you get closer to the Antarctic continent.
Oh, yes, certainly. Anywhere near land, particularly the Capes, were notorious for shipwrecks. So the earlier mariners who worked out that they could, in fact, get to the Dutch East Indies and the British East Indies much more quickly. There's a whole long story about the development of those routes, the Brouwer route for the Dutch East Indies, which instructed, and it became compulsory, the Brouwer route, where they had to drop down into the higher southern latitudes in order to pick up those winds. And also to avoid the storms around the Cape itself, which it's a maelstrom around those capes, and you get
Is that because of the mixture of waters?
That's right. You get the southward flowing coastal currents meeting the ocean currents further south. And even if you read about modern day yacht people who are sailing on round the world yacht races, they all tick off those capes as their landmarks, and they are, you know, a badge of honour to have sailed around those capes. But you read their stories, and they are every bit as frightening and turbulent and life-threatening as it was in the 17th century. So in those early days, the mariners were looking for those winds, and they worked out that they could very quickly save many days of sailing instead of following the coast of Africa across to the Dutch East Indies, and of course also avoid any enemy ships and the risk of pirating. They were able to pick up those winds and then shoot across to off the coast of southern Australia. But the problem is, without a good understanding or good navigational tools and an understanding of longitude, it was very easy to overshoot the mark. And one of the first shipwrecks off the western Australian coast was a British ship called the Trial, which actually didn't turn northward quickly enough, and was heading to the East Indies, and is wrecked. And it was one of the earliest known shipwrecks off Western Australia. But this became a pattern. There was a lot of risk in picking up those winds. So they were not only, this region was not only awe-inspiring and beautiful in its way, it was also very fast, but it was also highly risky.
Yeah. The other thing that I found so interesting about your book was that you describe this kind of set of mysteries that people see in the Southern Ocean. For example, penguins, these emperor penguins, which are so large, or the first people who encounter the Fuegians, the people who live on the tip of South America. Why did they so attract people's attention?
Well, there's a number of kind of interweaving stories there. I just might mention that one of the interesting things about the high southern latitudes is because it was it took such a long time to actually reach that region and to really start to explore it, and because of its ice and winds and so on, it discouraged a lot of early exploration. So, in fact, the Southern Ocean, I think, for most of human history, has existed more in the imagination than in reality. Mm. And it was really only the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries that we started to really understand the ocean, the nature of this ocean. And just you mentioned Tierra del Fuego. That was, of course, Cook sailed around there, as did Charles Darwin about 50 years later in the Beagle. And the impression was in both of those voyages, those major voyages of exploration and discovery in the southern regions, the sense that the southern part of the world was somehow inferior to the north, that you were moving into a more primitive, more basic, uncivilized world. And so that kind of idea stayed in the literature for quite a long time. And so when we get to the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the race to the South Pole, the era as we know it during the early 20th century of the Antarctic heroic narratives of Scott and Shackleton and people like that. So that was the beginning of a sort of growing awareness of the southern regions as being a fascinating treasure trove, if you like, of not only of the natural environment and the emerging ideas that came with Darwin's theory of evolution, but also almost as a way of seeing those evolutionary processes in practice. So the Emperor Penguin is an interesting story. The Emperor Penguin is, of course, the largest of the penguins. There's about 18 or so species. All penguins live in the southern hemisphere. The Emperor Penguin is the only penguin that actually breeds on ice in the winter. It's an incredible story of survival, and I won't go into the detail of how they do that, but suffice to say that they're nearly a metre tall. They are a magnificent bird, and they work together as a community to survive in those extreme environments. So when the Antarctic explorers started venturing into this region, the first to take a great interest in the Emperor Penguin and its particular habits was Dr. Edward Wilson, who accompanied Scott on the Discovery Expedition in 1901 to 1903. Edward Wilson was, of course, a surgeon, but he was also the part role of a naturalist on the voyage. And he was intrigued by the fact that when he saw the fledglings in summer, he worked out that they must have been hatched in midwinter. So when he returned on the Terra Nova expedition, that fateful expedition in which Scott and Wilson died, he was very keen to collect eggs. And the eggs, at the time, the theory was the eggs would be show the evidence in the embryos of the evolutionary process, if you like. So it was well known at the time that there was an interesting evolutionary link between reptiles and birds. And it was thought at the time that the emperor penguin was one of the most primitive birds, and therefore it's the embryos of its eggs would reveal its earlier evolutionary form. This was the theory at the time. So perhaps one of the most memorable narratives to come out of that whole expedition before the death of Scott and Wilson on the way, the tragic return. Before that happened, Wilson, together with Cherry Garrard, who was a young zoologist on the trip, and Henry Birdie Bowers, as he was known, the three of them set out on an expedition to recover eggs, of living eggs of emperor penguins, which meant, of course, they had to undertake that expedition in midwinter. And they did so in complete darkness. I still to this day don't know how they managed it. And it took them 5 weeks to get to Cape Crozier, which was where Wilson had previously sighted a penguin, an emperor penguin colony. They got there, they retrieved 5 eggs. Two of them broke on the return journey. Not surprisingly, they were trekking through minus 60 degrees Celsius conditions. And that's a whole story in itself.
The other thing that I found so interesting about your book is that as much as it's focused on the Southern Ocean as a place in and of itself, you actually show how intimately connected it is with the rest of the world. my background is on Arctic exploration in the 19th century. And at that time, people who were interested in climate and meteorology were saying if we could just crack the code of what happens in the Arctic, we could understand, we could create a kind of theory of how climate works around the world. And I'm realizing that that story is at least as equally true, if not more true, for the Southern Ocean, that people are looking to these discoveries that you're talking about, and they're trying to figure out much bigger questions. So, for example, I was very interested in the fact that after, I think, was it the Challenger expedition, mm-hmm. which is doing oceanographic research, you have John Walter Gregory, mm-hmm. a meteorologist, who says, we need to, you know, if you want to figure out why the droughts are so bad in Australia, you got to look to the Southern Ocean. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I think that the relationship between the Southern Ocean and the history of climate, and indeed the history of meteorology as a science, is fascinating. We think of the ocean as, you know, a marine environment, but of course it's just as much about the atmosphere as well in that region. The Challenger expedition was important in collecting massive amount of data, a massive amount of 50 volumes or so of data, which was published over a very long period of time. And what that was showing was detailed readings of temperature of ocean water in different places. And there was an emerging understanding of the relationship between the currents that flow around the southern continents and the climatic conditions on the land masses associated with them. So by the time Gregory, who was a geologist at the University of Melbourne, I believe, for a while, professor of geology, geography, I beg your pardon, he was a geographer. He was interested in the idea that because Australia was in the middle of an eight-year drought, probably one of the worst droughts, well, it was the worst drought, in settler memory at least, around the turn of the 20th century, it lasted from about the mid-1890s through to about 1904. And so everyone was focused on how do we understand the weather patterns better? How can we have predictions of when we're going to have drought so that provision can be made for it? And it was a question of critical importance. So when Gregory started talking about the Challenger's results and the fact that we still knew so little about the Southern Ocean and its impact on Australian climate, it really was the beginning of a whole new science in a way. So the Australian and New Zealand Meteorological Service developed at that time after the model that had been established in India. And from then on, you ended up with the emerging science of oceanography and the ways in which currents influence climate patterns, not just in Australia, but indeed around the world. So the 20th century, I think, has really been a massively important time of emerging understanding, and the science is still going on. It's still an area of absolute importance now, particularly in the context of climate change. So the scientists that are working now, it's an international sort of laboratory in a sense now. The Southern Ocean has become understood to be an engine house of current flow, which, because of the amount of ice, and I'm not a scientist, so I can't explain the physics of it, but as the sea ice freezes, the water around it becomes denser, more salty, and sinks. And so that causes I think it's called thermohaline circulation, where the dense water sinks to the bottom and then pushes northward. So in fact, whilst you have the Antarctic circumpolar current going around the world from west to east, you also have a deep current which pushes along the bottom and gradually rises to meet the warmer waters around the Antarctic convergence, and is part of a global circulation system. Wally Broker, I think, an American oceanographer, talked about it as I said before, the engine house of the world. So this is an area that I think is so interesting, and yet it's hard to get your head around because it's a complex sort of scientific
system.
But the work is going on, and climate scientists now look very closely at what's happening around Antarctica with melting ice, with changes in salinity, with acidification of the Southern Ocean, and are realising that many of the questions about climate change and what's predicted to happen isn't just about weather, it's also about world climate.
Yeah. It strikes me that you've done so many different kinds of writing in your professional career. You're an academic. You've done your PhD writing. I know that you also have written policy writings for the Australian government. And this book is neither of those things. It's kind of a combination. It's an academic work, but you're clearly also trying to reach out and cross over to serious lay readers. And I was wondering, what was that like as a process to write this book? What did it feel very different from the other kinds of writing you did? Was that challenging?
Actually, I loved writing it. It was in the same way that I found putting the ocean at the centre of the story liberating, I found this kind of writing was much more of an emotional experience than I expected. I became absolutely passionate about the ocean and its history in a way that I didn't expect to. So I began the process by, you know, the usual kind of approach of reading sort of secondary materials and then delving into archives and reading a lot of primary sources and of course, drawing on my own experiences. And I think probably having the freedom to kind of really bring my own ideas into it. And I should say they formed as I was writing. They weren't necessarily already there. I kind of went on a personal journey too into this ocean. And so I combined my own reflections on the experience of being in the Roaring Forties, for example, and then last year having ventured into the Antarctic region by ship and actually sailing across the Drake Passage, landing on some sub-Antarctic islands and experiencing it firsthand, brought to the process of writing a very different and, as I say, a very emotional kind of response to what prior to that was probably more of an academic exercise. And I think what has helped is that I've spent years working as a public historian. So I've spent a lot of time, you know, undertaking oral histories with communities and finding out how people think about their past, how they remember things, how they relate to the natural world. And I suppose in a way I brought a lot of that to this book. I was really writing with the ideas of, you know, what does this mean for us and our future? I suppose by the end of it, I became absolutely passionate about bringing this region to the world because it just seems to have been ignored or very much seen in a narrow way. It is a very complex history, and really I've just touched the surface of it, literally.
Well, Joy McCann, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, great pleasure. Thanks, Michael.
That's it for today. The music for Time to Eat the Dogs was composed by Zabrat. If you'd like to recommend a guest or offer an opinion, please email me at timetoeatthedogs, that's one word, lowercase, @gmail.com. And please rate the show and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. It's really one of the best ways of reaching new listeners who might be interested in the show. See you next week.